Okay, I think we're about ready to start. Again, this is the public meeting for the NTIA Low Power Television and Translator Digital Upgrade Program. My name is William, or Bill Cooperman. I'm a director of the Broadcast Division, and what I'd like to do to start this off is to introduce the head of NTIA, Meredith Atwell Baker.
Well, I want to thank Bill Cooperman, whose dedication to this program has been really insurmountable. He has just been a great advocate, and we are grateful for his leadership. And I know that he will give you a great program today, and I'm sure he's looking forward to seeing everybody in Las Vegas as well. So welcome to you all in the room. We appreciate your coming, and importantly to you all online as well. NTI has been deeply involved, obviously, in the whole digital transition with the coupon program and the low-power conversion program, and we are extremely pleased now to be bringing the low-power upgrade program to you. And so I know this is an important meeting. We're excited about getting it kicked off. Bear with us as the rulemaking sometimes is processes a little unwieldy for those who haven't been through it, but we will. I promise that you have the dedication of our team to enact this as efficiently and as quickly as we can, and we really are just pleased to be at this point now starting this program. So I'm just thank you for your willingness to be here with us to participate, and we're grateful to you. And again, Bill Cooperman's the man, and I'm going to turn it back over to Bill.
Thank you very much, Meredith. I'd also like to introduce the head of this particular office, the Office of Telecommunications Information Applications, which was responsible, direct responsibility for all of the deficit reduction digital television programs that we have here at NTIA, including little things like the coupon program. You may have heard of that somewhere along the line. Dr. Bernadette McGuire-Rivera.
Thank you, Bill, and hello to everyone out there on the web. And the people who are here with us today are some groups that we have been working with for a long time here at NTIA and many grant programs and policy issues. I want to start out by thanking Meredith and Secretary Gutierrez on all of the transition programs. I've been here, gosh, since 1995, and this is really the highest level I've ever seen of secretarial and assistant secretarial involvement and in these sorts of things, and they have just tirelessly traveled all over. Meredith has just, she must have 2 million airline miles now. Secretary Gutierrez has been great helping us with his marketing knowledge, and also he is just so willing to go out and speak and give these programs visibility. And as you can imagine, a lot of us here are eagerly waiting for February 17th, but here at OTIA, and particularly in the broadcast division, we are well aware that the transition will not really be over until all of you and with your low power and translator stations have made the transition. And we're very honored to be working with you on the upgrade program, which will be $65 million that will be available to help you with this. Now, for all of us here, $65 million is a lot of money. But also there are a lot of translator and low power stations. So for that reason, it's very important that we get these rules right. I know a lot of the people who've worked with us are the public TV folks, and I don't think a lot of you may not have been born when the first rules were done. But a rulemaking is it's important because we get public comment. And this one, we're going to do everything we can to expedite it, and Bill will go through the timeline with you. But it's important that you participate in this, because as I said, $65 million is a lot of money. There are a lot of translators, so it's important that we get the rules right so that the money is used in the most efficient way and the money goes where it needs to go. And in order for us to do that, we need you to comment. You can't complain later unless you comment now. So it's very important that you do this, and you do it in writing, so what you need and what you want about this program are on the public record. So I want to thank all of you again, and Bill will introduce your program officers, who are some of the most patient and wonderful people. I know a lot of you have worked with Lynn and Larry, and we got Brian from CPB. So these, and they are real experts, particularly in working with rural broadcasters. So they will be very patient with you, and if you'll be patient with us, as Meredith noted, in this rulemaking, I think this program will really make a very important difference in people in rural areas being able to get this wonderful digital television that we're all going to enjoy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Bernie. What I'd like to do now is begin the presentation here, really a discussion. This is really the first step in beginning to set up this upgrade program. Some background, just for the record, of low-power television. We know that there are about 7,000 low-power television facilities in the United States. About 60% of those are translators. 2,000 or a third are LPTV stations, and then there are about 528 Class A stations. As you all know, these stations can all operate in analog after February 17, 2008. The FCC has not established a digital deadline at this point, but is permitting stations to either a flash cut going directly to digital or to construct a digital companion channel. So we at NTIA actually have two programs. They're now on slide three. We have two programs to help translators in low-power facilities deal with the digital transition. The first program is already in operation, has been in operation for a year. We announced the digital-to-analog conversion program last October. This provides for $1,000 grants so that if a low-power station wants to continue to broadcast in analog, it will be able to pick up its digital full-power station, convert that down into analog, and then continue to broadcast in analog. That program has $3.5 million available until the middle of November, at which time we will then reduce that amount to $1 million. For the last 3 months of the program. This is a means of encouraging stations to get applications in, and also the Congress has recognized that the converter box coupon program could use some additional funds and assistance for providing technical assistance and education, so some of the funds that were originally devoted to the conversion program will be used for the coupon program. But $3.5 million at $1,000 each is $3,500 stations, or half of the translators, would be eligible and able to be funded with this $3.5 million. We know that a lot of the translators do not need this kind of assistance because they receive programming from satellite or by microwave, and therefore do not actually pick up a full-power digital TV station off-air, and that's what that program is intended to do. You can apply for that program online, www.ntia.doc.gov/LPTV, and all the information is right there. Today what we're going to do is talk about the second program. This is the digital upgrade program. And what we'd like to do in this meeting is really review the basic legislation that the Congress has passed that we have to implement. We will review that legislation and try to identify, and I think there are six major issues where we still need some input from you so that we can help design the program that best fulfills both the congressional intent and also meets your particular needs. We will be accepting written comments on this until November 14th, and those comments can be sent to lptv@ntia.doc.gov. I'll repeat that again, because if you're listening on the web right now, you can actually send some comments in right now. We have people here at the computer. We'll take your comments off and try to summarize them here in the meeting as well. So that email address again is lptv @ntia.doc.gov. Okay, let's take a look then at the legislation. For the lawyers in attendance, this slide shows the legislative citation, the public law, and the amendment that actually sets up the low-power translator upgrade program. The most of the information about the program is in the first section, Section A of Section 3009, and I'm on slide number 6 now. It's very difficult to read, so what I'm going to do is break it down, I think, into the 6 major areas. It says that we can establish a program not to exceed $65 million. Secondly, the term of the program is from fiscal 2009 through 12. It talks about each licensee of an eligible low-power television station. The fourth item on slide number 10 is that they may receive reimbursement. So this is a reimbursement program, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. It's to upgrade low-power stations from analog to digital. So I think a key word here is upgrade, and what does that really mean? And then finally, the sixth item here in this paragraph talks about eligible rural communities. Those stations have to be inside eligible rural communities. So to kind of summarize the 6 basic parameters in that paragraph, we're talking $65 million program, 4 fiscal years, 9 through 12, and of course we have just entered fiscal 9 in the federal calendar, so that's why we're starting the program right now. We're talking about eligible low-power television stations, reimbursement, upgrading, and eligible rural communities. There are some issues that therefore need to be addressed. What are eligible stations? What's an eligible rural community? What kind of costs should the program provide and support? There's something else that was not in the first paragraph we'll get to later. The legislation also does talk about priority reimbursement. What dates are eligible, and then how to select recipients. So what I'd like to do now is then go through each one of these 6, talk a little bit about them, and then have an opportunity for discussion and questions after each individual section. So we talk about eligibility of the station, for example. Going back to Section 309, it talks about a program for which each licensee of an eligible low-power station. Actually, the legislation does have a definition that does help. Section B of this legislation talks about eligible stations. And it actually, we're on slide number 18 at the moment, it does actually say that eligible stations are low-power television broadcast stations, Class A stations, translator stations, and booster stations. So that is fairly clear. Have to be either one of those, and I think it covers basically the entire low-power community. But then the legislation also continues, and there are kind of 2 conditions on that. Subsection 1 and subsection 2. Let's take a look at subsection 2 first. It says that an eligible station has to be that has not converted from analog to digital operations prior to the date of enactment. And that date of enactment was February 8, 2006. So that, I think, is pretty clear also. You cannot not have converted from analog to digital before February 2006 by statute. But let's take a look at the first section now. It says that is itself broadcasting exclusively in analog format. And I think this raises a couple of questions. What does broadcasting mean? Does it mean that a station has to have an analog license? Or that it's broadcasting in analog perhaps under test authority and does not have a license yet? Or perhaps that the station only has a construction permit for an analog facility? These are issues that we at NTIA are going to have to resolve and would like your comments and input on. It also says exclusively in analog format. couple of questions come to our minds. At what date do they have to be exclusively broadcasting in analog? Is that February 2006 when the legislation was passed, or perhaps when NTIA actually puts out the guidelines for the program, or the closing date when an application is received, or perhaps some other dates? And should this date be the same date for all applicants? And what happens if a station is already operating a digital companion channel? If a station is operating a digital companion channel, is it truly broadcasting exclusively in analog format? Those are the kinds of issues that we at NTIA would like your thoughts on, your comments on. Again, you can email your comments, your thoughts to lptv@ntia.doc.gov. We will be accepting those until November 14th. If you've just joined the audio webcast, we do have the PowerPoint slides available. They are on the same homepage that you use to access the audio stream here. We're currently on slide number 23, so if you want to open that up and catch up with us, this is a perfect opportunity to do so. We have already received some email comments regarding this particular issue. For example, a gentleman from Oregon Public Broadcasting says that any licensed LPTV or translator that's on the air or has a CP on the date that the legislation was passed should be eligible. But on the other hand, Robert Pettit, who operates KRHP in the Dalles, Oregon, says, I wouldn't think that a construction permit or test authority would be what the legislators intended here. A couple of other people from Montana, Lee Good and Mr. Conliato, say a construction permit would not qualify for funds as it is not operational. They also note that there are many STA-authorized translators presently in operation, and they must be included in the process. So an STA translator may not actually be, I guess they're not fully licensed. They don't really fall into any one of the three categories that we had already identified: licensed, program test authority, or applying for a license, or having a CP. They're actually broadcasting under an STA. And therefore, how should NTIA recognize those particular facilities? In the conversion program, the first program that we are currently in operation, we indicated we established a date sometime after the publication of the notice regarding the of the conversion program, and said that a station had to at least apply for an FCC license by that date certain, because in applying for an FCC license, the station had basically already finished construction, and therefore was operational. Whether we should hold to that same standard or a different standard, we are inviting your thoughts and comments on. Do we have any comments from or questions from those here at the moment on this particular issue? Yes, sir. One, could you please use the microphone because this is being webcast, and also if you would kindly identify yourself and your organization just so we can all hear it.
Yes, I'm Donald Everest of Cohen DePellin Everest. One thing I just want to point out on the STA comment, and that's very, very poignant, is that many stations that have had been displaced for some reason or have had unique circumstances, like they missed the renewal deadline but wanted to continue operating, the commission will not allow it to have a new license on analog but will remain on STA. So you may want to consider those as being operating because they do have a history. Because of the unique circumstances they found themselves in during the process, that's the way the commission has maintained its service.
Okay, appreciate the comment. Thank you very much. And we are taking these comments down here, but we would certainly appreciate, you know, written comments. Written comments are just that much more formal and easier to get into the record, and we will post all of the written comments that we receive on the Internet as well. Any other comments here at the moment or questions? Okay. If not, we can then move along to the second section, which is eligibility of community. We're now on slide number 25, if you're following along at home. Remember, the legislation talks about low-power television stations. I have to say this very carefully. In, next word, eligible communities. Ineligible rural communities, actually, as that term is defined, and then the legislation has a reference to another section of the U.S. Code, and if you have not memorized the U.S. Code, the next slide actually does tell us what the citation is in section 610B2 of the Rural Electrification Act of 1937, which says that a rural eligible community is any area of the United States that is not contained in an incorporated city or town with a population in excess of 20,000 inhabitants. And remember that it's almost like a double negative here in this particular piece of legislation, that's not contained in an incorporated city with a population of excess of 20,000. So it's really saying is it's an area where the communities are less than 20,000. This is extremely important because in order to be eligible for this program, this is a basic eligibility criteria, you must serve an eligible rural community. So, how do we define eligible rural communities? Well, there are a number of ways I think that we can. And that we would invite, again, your comments, written comments, lptv@ntia.doc.gov. We are equipped to receive those comments right now and bring those to the forum during this meeting. One of those possibilities is simply to look at the community of license, and we're in slide number 27 right now. The community of license is less than 20,000, then a station would be eligible, and there are about 5,000 of the 7,000 facilities, low-power stations, translators, Class A's, that are located within communities of less than 20,000. We could look at population within an FCC service contour. And then on slide number 29, we actually show, you know, some possibilities for FCC service contours. And they vary depending on what contours you would select. We'd select a grade A, we'd select a grade B, or the particular contours that are appropriate for low-power facilities, which are 62 dB for channels 2 through 6, and then 74 dB for the UHF stations. I suppose it would be possible to calculate those as well. We could look at just simply if there is no metro area greater than 20,000 within that service contour. That's another possibility. We could even see how the Department of Agriculture, and since this is a rural utility service part of the Department of Agriculture, how the Rural Utility Service actually implements the same kind of legislation in some of its other programs, such as the Rural Public TV Digital Transition Grant Program. There's a reference here. They do that through a fairly complex formula. Their formula uses school lunch programs and things of that nature. I'm not sure that would be appropriate for this program, but they do a percentage of rurality, for example, and that's certainly a possibility. When is an urban area primarily rural but includes an urban area of more than 20,000, do you subtract out the population, or how would you calculate population in something of that nature? For example, we did receive a comment here from, in written form earlier, from Judy Stiles, general manager of KCGS in Joplin, Missouri, and this is what she says. In the case of KGCS, our community of license, Joplin, Missouri, has a population in excess of 20,000 people. However, every other community within our broadcast range is under the benchmark, with most communities under a population of 10,000. KGCS reaches throughout a 10-county area of southwest Missouri, etc., the majority being rural areas. The total number of potential households reached by our station is over 187,000. Consideration needs to be given to stations such as ours that are licensed to a larger city but have a strong impact and service to rural areas. And we thank you for that comment. This concludes the second section. Are there received anything over the web yet? Not yet. Okay. Comment here. Yes, sir.
Yes, it's Donald Everest again. One thing about the coverage, you wish to have it defined as interference-free or just particularly assuming a contour and a coverage contour, assuming it does not receive any interference?
Well, I would throw the question back on you and ask what your recommendation would be. Normally, if one goes to the FCC's website and plugs in the call letters, any station can get the FCC contour very simply.
Fair enough. Then that comes into the next question of whether you want it on a standard prediction methodology or whether you want it on Longley Rice, since they're now transitioning to Longley Rice. I only point these out. I don't have a personal preference. Mm-hmm. But there's other communities that have been long licensed that do not serve their principal community based on their contour. The situation has long been recognized that that television receivers don't read the FCC rules. And so people receive signals by other means, in other words, adjusting their antennas or whatever. So the question then comes down to whether those stations are going to be excluded if they should not happen to serve that particular area based on Washington, D.C. methodology. I only point that out because that is a long-term issue, and I just don't I want to raise the question so it can be addressed at some juncture. Thank you.
Appreciate that, and that is certainly something that we'd like more comments on and more input on. The question of how it should be calculated is quite frankly a part of the issue, but also one that is how that calculation is done. As I mentioned, any station can go to the FCC's website and by punching a button, coming up with what the FCC's predicted and licensed contour is. And, of course, we also have to recall that most of the low-power facilities, 60% of them are translators and are secondary service. And so while they have an FCC authorization and they have a predicted contour, the facility itself can be preempted by another facility. Going to something more stringent, perhaps more real world, like a Longley Rice, would require perhaps something beyond what an individual station can calculate. And whether that's something that we at NTIA could do or whether that would be something that a station facility would have to do as part of an application process, I think is a question that we have to look at, and that stations need to consider whether they can assume that burden, or perhaps whether NTIA could do something of that nature. We did receive a comment here from Greg Best in your estimates of the number of eligible facilities. What authorizations are you including? CPs licensed only, I believe. So far, we've only looked at licensed facilities. So that 5,000 figure for it was a community of licensed for licensed facilities. We do recognize that there are a lot of construction permits out there, and that's one of the issues I think that we'll be talking about in a few moments when we talk about dates. As to how exactly do we deal with facilities that are coming online at this particular point. If there are no further questions here and we have nothing else further from the web, why don't we move on then to the third section. We're on slide number 34, and again, if you're just joining us, all of the slides, the PowerPoint presentation is available online at the basically at the same homepage that you joined for the audio streaming webcast here. We're now talking about eligible costs. And again, on the next slide, going to the legislation. The legislation just says that may receive reimbursement for equipment to upgrade low-power television stations from analog to digital. Let's take a look at part of that. It says equipment to upgrade low-power stations from analog to digital. Obviously, what equipment and what costs should be eligible for the program? We recognize that there are many different stations, and there's a lot of different kinds of technology that those stations use. Some of those may be easily upgradable from analog to digital. Some of them are perhaps impossible to upgrade from analog to digital. So how can we retrofit, modify, or replace the existing equipment? And then the question of whether NTIA should actually fund digital companion channels. Are those an upgrade, or are those perhaps beyond an upgrade? How should we deal with that? We're upgrading equipment, and here's just a list of possible equipment and possible costs that people have suggested that might be funded by the program. Obviously, the more equipment the program funds, the fewer potential stations we'd be able to support, more equipment, the higher dollar figures. We'll talk about that in a moment here, because obviously that's a major concern. Should there be a cap or a limit on the amount of awards, funds that's awarded to a single station or perhaps to a single licensee? If there's a cap, what should be based on? How should we calculate that? Maybe on a power level basis, whether it's a tube type or a solid-state translator, the age of the translator, et cetera. And then a very important question, how should the applicants, when should the applicants start spending their funds that would be eligible for reimbursement? Or to put it another way, can we get retroactive money for those stations that have already spent money and have already started the conversion process? Those are lots of questions. We've had a good number of input already here, for example. Oregon Public Broadcasting has suggested that NTIA should cover 25% of the installation costs and 50% of the hard costs. Charlie Caniato and Lee Good from Montana suggest that the equipment to be replaced must be confined to only the devices that absolutely require replacement, i.e. analog translators, so that antennas, cables, preamps, towers, building improvements would not qualify. And they even go further, and they suggest that perhaps there might be a cap, for example, if we're talking about a project for a 1-watt analog VHF translator, that replacement cost might be $6,200. On the other hand, at the other extreme, their comments are if we're talking about a 100-watt UHF translator, that might be capped at $20,000 or $20,500, and they're including $500 in their costs for installation. Robert Pettit, again from KRHP, thought that any equipment needed, such as translators, encoders, modulators, PSIP generators, antennas, and needed equipment, testing equipment, should be reimbursed, including installation costs. Both retrofitting and new equipment should be eligible. So there are lots of suggestions. National Translator Association thought that translators with no channel change needed and analog equipment suitable for a digital modification, probably $4,000 to $6,000, depending on the particular circumstances. On the other hand, translators that are not suitable for conversion to digital operation or to the final digital channel, recognizing that some of the low-power facilities are going to have to change channels, they may be out of core. NTA continues, considering a 100-watt analog output in most cases would be replaced by a 30-watt digital output, requires a translator and antenna, we suggested a $20,000 cap is a good compromise between covering all costs and having a reasonable funding level for all applicants. Are there any comments here from the group at the moment? We do have another comment from Greg Besk asking, are the reimbursements funded at 100% or some other given percentage, such as 50%? And obviously, this is a question that we need to decide and a question that we'd like your comments on. Again, we are receiving written comments here. You can just email to lptv@ntia.doc.gov. We will receive those and try to incorporate those into the discussion today. Or you can submit your written comments again to that email address through November 14th. So you have opportunities both today and through November in order to provide some input here. Obviously, the more dollars we put into any particular project, the fewer projects are potentially available for funding. Yes, a question or comment.
Hi. Melina Barzilai, the Association of Public Television. This might be sort of a dense question, but I understand this is a reimbursement program. Does that contemplate station applying for approval to spend X amount and then after that point, they would spend that money and then apply for reimbursement to get the money back?
Excellent question, and thank you for raising that because I think that's going to come up, I think, next or pretty close to it. Okay? Yeah. Those are very good questions. And if there's nothing else here at the moment, why don't we move on to the fourth item, priority reimbursement. I did not cover this in the beginning discussion of Section 309A, but it is a continuation of 309A. And let's look at that. Here it says on slide number 42 for easy reading, a priority reimbursement shall be given to, and then it says, licenses held by a nonprofit corporation. And then it talks about stations that serve rural areas of fewer than 10,000 viewers. So there are two conditions there. Let's look at the first one first. priority reimbursements where a license is held by a nonprofit corporation. And I point out for the lawyers in the group that it says nonprofit corporation, does not say nonprofit association. And there are differences between the two. And the question has been raised, can government bodies qualify as nonprofit corporations? Now, some government bodies do have, you know, separate corporate charters or do qualify in many states under what would be considered, I guess, like an IRS 501c ruling or determination. Other governmental bodies perhaps do not. But the legislation talks about priority being given to when a license is held by a nonprofit corporation. So we would appreciate your comments and thoughts on that. It also says priority reimbursements will be given to areas that serve rural areas of fewer than 10,000 viewers. So I guess the question here, again, we're back to one of how determining population. Do we use, you know, what benchmark do we use here for the 10,000 viewers, and is it the same benchmark that we used for the eligibility determination of 20,000? Not an easy question to answer by any means. And finally, we just point out that there is an and here. Priority reimbursements shall be given to eligible stations where the license is held by a nonprofit corporation and stations that serve eligible rural areas. So does this mean that stations have to meet both of the criteria, or maybe you give priority to a station that meets one, but you give extra priority to a station that meets both? And if you give a priority, how do you recognize that priority? You have a special grant round in the beginning just for those stations that meet a priority, or you give extra points or fund priority stations first during a regular grant round. A number of ways that can be addressed. In the conversion program, we had a separate period of time when we just accepted applications from stations that met the priority for the conversion program, for the $1,000 program. That was a three-month period. So again, a whole series of issues as to the priority section. The statute requires that we provide a priority. Let's see, we did receive some comments regarding the priority. Judy Stiles from Joplin, Missouri, KGCS, again wrote that we believe that governmental subsidiaries should be considered a nonprofit corporation qualifying for priority reimbursement. Robert Pettit from KRHP in the Dales said priority level should only be given to those stations who meet both criteria. They must serve a community of less than 10,000 and their FCC license must be held by a nonprofit. Oregon Public Broadcasting said we should give priority to those serving 10,000 or less, and then they actually gave a priority ranking kind of within that. A priority ranking should be first nonprofits, including 501c3 organizations, second to those areas of under 10,000, third to those areas of under 20,000, and then finally for those areas with a total population, as I read this, of over 20,000 if the funds are available, I guess to address those rural areas or areas that are primarily rural but still have some metro areas, some urbanized areas within that. And we received, you know, similar comments. National Translator Association, they actually indicated that priority should be on a first-come, first-served basis if it's necessary to establish priorities based on the applicant. It would be translators serving no more than 10,000 people, and then, I guess, applicants from a non-commercial educational status and an educational mission. And the question arose, many translators from Greg Best, many translators that provide non-commercial service are part of public broadcast systems. Are these interpreted to be governmental bodies? Well, I think some public broadcasting systems are governmental bodies and some are not. Some are simply private, private nonprofit organizations, most of which, I think all of which, are nonprofit corporations insofar as they have an IRS 501c, C3 designation. But not all of them, perhaps, are governmental bodies. So we have some varying thoughts here, regarding how the priority should be designated and even how priority should be defined. Again, if you want to email some comments to us, the address, the email address is lptv@ntia.doc.gov. We will accept your comments right now. I've been reading some of those that have come in over the line. We will also be accepting comments at that same email address until November 14th. Is there any questions here from those in attendance? If not, we will move on to the fifth item, which is effective dates. We're on slide number 48. If you're following along at home on the PowerPoint, that PowerPoint is available at the same website that you picked up the webcast here, the audio stream. Just pick it up, and we're now at slide number 48, and we're looking at the fifth issue that we had addressed earlier, effective dates. If you go back to the legislation really doesn't talk very much about dates. It says that we can make payments during fiscal years 2009 through 12. It says that we can do reimbursements starting February 18th, 2009. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, that eligible stations have not converted from analog to digital prior to the effective date of the legislation or February 8th of 2006. The legislation passed in February of 2006, and of course, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about the fact that stations had to be broadcasting in analog and could not have converted prior to February 8th of 2006, but then, as has been pointed out, there's a 2.5-year gap between the effective date of the legislation in February 2006 and the start date of the program, which is August 1st of 2008. And so what happens to all of those stations that came online between February of 2006 and either October 1st of 2008 or whenever we start, you know, issue guidelines or accept applications? So those stations that have suggested that we use a February 8th, 2006 start date, for example, for date of station eligibility, what date must a station actually be eligible, be broadcasting exclusively in analog in order to qualify for the program? And then there's perhaps an expenditure start date. What date, what's kind of the start date after which an applicant can spend their funds and then be reimbursed by the program? What are those two dates, and should those two dates be the same? And we've received a number of comments suggesting February 8th, 2006 as the date. But then I asked the question, what happens to those stations that only had a CP, for example, in February 2006 and are now broadcasting exclusively in analog? What does the program do with those stations? How do we bring those stations in? Or those stations that have begun to spend funds and may have already converted prior to the issuance of any guidelines or any regulations for the program. Should retroactive expenditures be permitted? Should we fund those on a retroactive basis when they had no information as to whether or not the program would accept those costs? Some stations may have held off waiting for guidelines from the program. Other stations went ahead and obviously had their own funds to go ahead and convert. Again, we are looking for thoughtful comments, suggestions as to how we can fit this square peg in a round hole for this and all of the other issues here that we've identified, including the last one that's coming up in a few moments. We have some comments, again, that came in earlier. National Translator Association, it's recommended that the eligibility be extended retroactively to any translator that's not converted to digital operations prior to the enactment, which appears to be February 8, 2006. Teresa Jaska, County Coordinator from Kuching-Ching County in Minnesota, says, please consider a realistic timeline when the grantee would have to complete the conversion to be eligible. Kuching-Ching County, owner of an LPTV station, runs its budget on a calendar year. And since we would not be eligible to apply, we would be able to apply for a grant until sometime in 2009, we can't apply in the project for a budget in 2009 because they're a governmental agency and they obviously work on years advanced funding so that they would not apply for the 2009 and do the conversion in 2010. Please allow a 1 to 2 year timeline from receipt of the award to project completion. Judy Stiles from KGCS in Joplin also says that stations that have already made the move to a digital should be eligible for reimbursement. Oregon Public Broadcasting suggests that January 1st, 2008 be the date after which applicants can start spending money that may be able to be reimbursed. So we have a comment here from Richard Kidder in Fresno, who says that priority, he's chief engineer at KNXT in Fresno, California, priority should not be given on a first-come, first-served basis. We should formulate a point system that can be applied to each applicant, giving 1 point for each condition met. Stations should be awarded grants for the most points, with the most points getting the highest priority. And that really does lead us directly into the sixth issue, which is how to conduct the program. Because, obviously, no matter what criteria I think we use, many stations would qualify. Probably thousands of stations would qualify. So what we would need to do is come up with an efficient way that stations could apply, perhaps a web-based, and it must be efficient for NTIA to process. But then the question is, how does NTIA distribute the funds? And as Mr. Kidder has just suggested, really he's looking at option number three here on page 55 of the slides. He's suggesting a competitive grant program. I guess the question is then, what are the evaluation criteria, or on what criteria, how should NTIA then award points if it were a competitive grant program? You've already heard a suggestion. I think NTA suggested that it be on a first-come, first-served basis, in which case, how would NTIA provide a priority reimbursement? If it were on a first-come, first-served basis. Or another option would be uniform grants. If we had to award, take the $65 million and divide it by 7,000 somewhere around $8,000 or $9,000 per award. If we were only awarding, you know, grants to half the stations, $3,500, then obviously, you know, the funds would double to, you know, $15,000 or $20,000. Is that enough? Would that be enough for all stations, or is that, you know, sufficient to give every station some sort of support? And I think we have, comments really from, you know, all kinds of areas here. We've had some comments that it should be on a first-come, first-served basis. I think I already read one from NTA. We've had some that say it should be uniform. I believe Mr. Pettit from the Dales had suggested a formula where perhaps we come up with a uniform dollar figure. We kind of estimate the dollars, the number of applicants, and then divide it with a dollar figure. And then those that receive a priority perhaps have a multiplier. So if the uniform grant would be like $20,000, then we have a multiplier of 1.1, so that if you receive a priority, your cap would be like $22,000, 1.1 times. Times 20,000, and if you're not receiving the priority, then your multiplier would be like 0.9. So that way, it's a uniform grant, but he's tried to suggest that there's a way of factoring the priority into that. There are another suggestion from someone here, and I cannot find the exact. Well, maybe I can. Judy Stiles from Joplin suggests that proposal to provide uniform grants would be best to serve all eligible applicants. But the comment that I was looking for suggested that there be a cap, but there be kind of like subcaps, so that while the station might have a cap of $20,000, we would put a cap of, let's say, $5,000 on, you know, like a transmitter portion, and so that a station could not exceed, you know, a cap, any one of the subcaps, and therefore the funds would be distributed to more stations that way. Obviously, if we go back to some of the earlier comments that I read related to power levels, there are some caps that are proposed by a couple of commenters based on power level. So the question here is, you know, how do we divvy up the funds? Uniform grants, perhaps with some kind of modification to that based on power levels or based on some kind of recognition of the priority system, which by statute we're authorized and required to provide to those stations that are under 10,000. Population served of under 10,000 or that are licensed to nonprofit corporations. Do we do it on a first-come, first-served basis, which several organizations and several commenters have already felt and recommended? But again, how do we do that, recognizing our obligation to provide priority? Or do we provide a competitive grant program, in which case, what are the evaluation criteria that we would use, recognizing that those evaluation criteria, if they are, should be pretty objective so that it's easy for the applicants to fill out an application form and not have to do, you know, written narratives and justifications and all of that sort of thing, but also something that would be relatively efficient for NTIA to administer if we are contemplating, you know, thousands of eligible stations coming to the program. Question was raised earlier about reimbursement as to whether or not, you know, stations can expend funds. You know, do they need to expend funds before an application is submitted or whether they can submit a proposal and then, you know, spend the funds, you know, get basically authorization to spend funds and then receive reimbursement back after that. An excellent question that we'd like some comments on. Your input is vital to the success and the continuation of this program, because we have no answers for these questions. I'll tell you right flat out. I do not have answers to these questions in the back of my pocket. There are lots of ways that this thing could go, and what we need to do is try to find the best way, and we're asking for your input as to how we can best put this program together. How should we space the program out over 4 fiscal years? We're authorized to spend money in fiscals 9, 10, 11, and 12. So theoretically, the last award could be made, you know, in September 2012. Should we divide the money evenly over the years? Should we front-load the money in the first couple of years, recognizing that stations need, you know, if you're going to do it, most stations want to do it now, and some stations may have to wait, but certainly there is a demand already evidenced. If a station, should a station present a digital authorization, FCC digital authorization, prior to submitting an application? No sense in funding a project that the Commission has not authorized or cannot authorize. Must a translator document that it can pick up a full-power TV it's rebroadcasting? If you're a translator, just because you can pick up a full-power television station today does not necessarily mean that you're going to be able to pick up that station next March or April after that station changes its channel, perhaps, changes its power, changes its physical location, because the digital transmitter may be at a different location than the analog transmitter that you're currently picking up. So should the translator document that it can pick up actually the full power station that it's proposed to rebroadcast? And then how long should the stations have to complete an upgrade project? You know, 1 year, 2 years, 18 months. If a project is not completed, then any funds that are, or even if it is completed, then any funds that are unexpended would be available to the program to make in subsequent award grants. So, you know, we can actually provide funds that have come back to the program and then potentially actually make out, you know, more awards than we actually have funds initially for. And finally, administrative procedures. The procedure for preparing an application, for submitting an application, how funds are paid, and any grantee post-award obligations. This is not the conversion program. The conversion program was $1,000. Stations basically filled out a single sheet of paper, answered about 5 questions, sent their application in, and if the questions, you know, were answered correctly and the station, everybody is eligible, then we automatically deposited, you know, $1,000 in the station's bank account. Very little paperwork. The department recognized that it was a very small program, very, very low level of awards, and so we expedited and waived a good number of departmental requirements and regulations and forms and contracts going back and forth and things of that nature for that program. Things will be different, I suspect, for this program when we're talking about $10,000 or $20,000, or, you know, conceivably more per station. It'll have to be a little more formalized. That's the end of this particular section. You have a question, comment?
Yes, Don Everest again.
Yeah.
How about those stations that might be in a coordination zone with Mexico, Canada, and have been on file for some period of time waiting action? I know that's a difficult question. I'm not expecting an answer. And the second is, what time frame do you envision that this proposed rulemaking will come to fruit with a court order or whatever your procedure is,
right.
And will you have to have a form approved by OMB in that process? Thank you.
Okay. Answer to the first question, Mexican-Canadian coordination. I think that's one of the reasons that we raised that issue, whether a station, you know, needs to come to the program with FCC authorization. You can probably hear in the background, we do have a little interference here. That's not feedback from the microphone. That's just simply an ambulance or fire engine going by. It'll pass in a moment. In the public telecommunications facilities program, which we also operate, we operate under kind of the same situation. NTIA is the funding agency. NTIA is not the authorizing agency for licenses that are required. And so in that particular program, we require that a facility have a license before an award is made. But it does allow a facility to come in. And we will process the application. That may be, you know, a solution here is that, you know, whether the facility needs to have the authorization before the application is submitted, or whether the facility needs the authorization before an award is made. But I would think in any circumstance that it would be difficult for the agency to award funds for a project that is, you know, that is not authorized by the FCC, particularly if we're talking about, you know, a finite amount of time in order to construct, whether we should commit federal dollars to a project that is not ready to proceed at that particular, you know, immediately upon award. The answer, I'm sorry, there were three questions, three parts. The one was the next step. And the timetable. We will be receiving written comments again at lptv@ntia.doc.gov until the middle of November, November 14th. Again, we invite your comments so that we can digest them, put together guidelines, and issue the next step. I wish I had a firm timetable. I don't, for a couple of reasons. One, I don't know the extent or the nature of the comments that are coming in. Secondly, let's be realistic and look at the calendar. There will be a transition in this department, in the federal government, in the next several months. How that factors in, I cannot speculate at this point. Other than simply to recognize the fact that it's there and we have to deal with it, and that's the environment that we live in. So we will do our best. This program was authorized by the legislation to start Fiscal 9. That was October 1st. We published the notice for this meeting on October 8th. Here we are on October 24th. We're trying to do this as rapidly as we possibly can. We do have another public meeting next Tuesday in Las Vegas, immediately after the Community Broadcasters Association, so that if you're planning to attend that meeting, we invite you to sift through the same slideshow, but at the same time, you have another opportunity to provide you know, further comments at that point. And the third question, the OMB form, the answer to that is yes. This is a new program. It will require a new application form, and that application form, I envision at this point at least, will, you know, have to receive clearance from OMB, and we'll have to go through that process as well. And that's, you know, not a insignificant process, as you're well aware. The federal government does have these requirements for the protection of everyone. That's an information collection and notification process. Are there any other further comments on this particular issue, either from here or from the field at this point? If not, let me just kind of review then where we are at this point in time. There is up to $65 million available, and let me just, you know, in the interest of full disclosure here, just simply, you know, let you know that we have to take some administrative costs out of that, obviously. This program is extending over 4 years. The continuing resolution, the fiscal 9 continuing resolution that passed on September 30th, does contain a provision that permits NTIA to use some of the funds from the upgrade program as well as some of the other programs that NTIA administers to administer the DTV converter box coupon program. No decision has been made as to the extent or how much funding would be required from any of these programs at this point. But since that converter box program, you know, February 18th is the deadline, we probably should know that, you know, by the first of the year or shortly thereafter. But at this point, I don't know what the impact is, so I can't speculate on that. But you know, it is indeed possible that that $65 million figure might be, you know, shaved a bit. Again, 4 fiscal years, reimbursement of expenditures. I'm now on slide number 62 for those at home following. It's to upgrade existing analog stations to digital, and the legislation, you know, specifically says low-power TV stations, Class A stations, translators, and even booster stations are eligible. Obviously, the input that we need, kind of to summarize here on the eligibility of stations, how should we define stations that are broadcasting exclusively in analog, and what date should that station or those stations be broadcasting exclusively in analog in order to qualify for the program? That's kind of a, you know, one of the key dates here. Another key issue is this eligibility of community. How to define whether a station serves a rural community, which is any area of the United States not contained in an incorporated city or town in excess of 20,000 inhabitants. What benchmark should we use? What kind of coverage or other kinds of benchmarks? And we are open on this and anything else here. I do not have a plan in my back pocket I can whip out and answer any of these questions. There are pros and cons. There are lots of different ways that have validity. We also need to look at what can be easily applied for on the behalf of a low-power facility, of a translator. How can you easily submit an application, and how can NTIA efficiently process what are potentially thousands of applications? What equipment costs should be eligible? Should there be a cap or a limit on a grant to a single station or to a single licensee even? If so, how should that be determined? And again, when should the applicants start spending, or when may the applicants start spending their funds so they'd be eligible for reimbursement? On priority reimbursement, how do we define a nonprofit corporation? How should we determine whether a station serves less than 10,000 viewers? Should we use that same benchmark for the 10,000 for priority as the 20,000 for baseline eligibility? Does the station have to meet both criteria in order to receive the priority, or can they receive, you know, perhaps extra credit if they meet both but just meets the threshold of one in order to receive a priority? And then how should that be implemented? Again, I've talked about the dates. I don't know that I need to repeat them here. The date, you know, what date does the station need to be eligible, and the date for expenditures, and should the two dates be the same? And then the final issue of how to conduct the program. Should there be uniform grants, first come, first serve, competitive, and how do we fit priority reimbursements in there and space the grants over the 4 fiscal years? If you have and are watching the slideshow here, you already know about LPTV at ntia.doc.gov. We have several of our staff here. Lynn Chadwick, you want to raise your hand, Lynn? Lynn Chadwick handles the applications and projects from the Rocky Mountain states. So if you're in one of the Rocky Mountain states, here's her telephone number, her email address. You have questions, you can just contact her directly. Larry Dyer is sitting in the back. Larry handles projects from the remainder of the U.S. west of the Mississippi River. And I'm not sure you have Minnesota, is that right? Okay, Minnesota is kind of split by the Mississippi, but in this case, we'll consider all of Minnesota west of the Mississippi River. And then finally, Brian Gibbons, who handles all the projects east of the Mississippi River. And why don't I just read off their phone numbers here. I know they'll really love this here, but Lynn Chadwick's phone number is 202-482-8338 if you don't have the PowerPoint in front of you but still want to contact her. 482-8338. Larry Dyer, west of the Mississippi, other than the Rocky Mountain states, 202-482-1762. And Brian Gibbons, east of the Mississippi, 202-482-6094. And you can contact them at any time. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. They will be all going out also to the Community Broadcasters Association next week, as will I. So you'll be able to meet them as well if you're going to be attending. We also have several others of our staff here today. Bob Sestilli in the back there. Bob, want to raise your hand, who also works with us, and Walter Shepard sitting down here as well, who will also be filling in and on reserve, working on both the PTFP and some of the other digital transition programs that we have here at NTIA. I just want to thank you very much for listening, for attending. I'm William Cooperman. There's my email address, wcooperman@ntia.doc.gov. But remember, please check our website, www.ntia.doc.gov/LPTV. This PowerPoint has already been posted on that website. And will remain on that website for quite a while, I'm sure. Written comments, you can send your written comments to lptv@ntia.doc.gov. And you can send those through November 14th, and we'll be very happy to receive your comments and put them, post them on the web so other people can see them and consider them as we develop the guidelines for this program. At this time, if there are any further questions, either from the floor or over the web, if not, I thank everyone for listening. Please contact us. We want to make this a very successful program. Your input is vital for us to do that. We want to make a program that will fulfills your needs in the low-power stations and translators and Class A stations within the confines and within the requirements that the statute has provided for us. And with that, I will say thank you very much. And if we can turn off the web, that goes for that. And thank you for coming.